Hi, everyone. This is Marion from the Talking Information Center, and this is the Patriot Ledger for Tuesday, April 7th. A Quincy man is charged with murdering his girlfriend. Details of the case of his charge with murdering his ex-girlfriend, including a goodbye phone call, an extremely large amount of blood, and cameras that accused installed to spy on his girlfriend, according to the prosecutor. Giovanni Garcia, age 34, was arraigned in Dedham's Norfolk Superior Court on Monday, April 8th. Pleading not guilty to murder, wiretapping, and strangulation. He was ordered held without bail by Norfolk Superior Court Judge William Sullivan. Police say Garcia strangled Adziri Cadenas Toreros, who ended their relationship before fatally cutting her throat inside a Quincy apartment at 500 Falls Boulevard on the night of December 13, 2025. Garcia then attempted to kill himself by cutting his neck, stomach, and wrist with a large knife, according to a police report. Paramedics pronounced Cadenas Toreros dead at the scene. Garcia was transported to a Boston Medical Center. Assistant District Attorney Beth McLaughlin told the court that Garcia's sister-in-law went to check on Garcia after listening to an alarming voicemail Garcia left for her husband. "Buddy, I'm putting you in charge of the kids, buddy," Garcia said, according to the statement of the case filed by McLaughlin. "Never give up, bro," the message continues, "and always remember that I love you a lot, dude. I love you a lot. Never give up, bro. There were no other options for me anymore, and take care of yourselves for me." Garcia answered his sister-in-law's knock covered in blood with cuts in his neck, stomach, and wrist, said McLaughlin. He told his sister-in-law that he killed Cadenas Toreros and he wanted to die. The sister-in-law found the woman's body in the bathroom, slumped over the tub with the shower running, with an extremely large amount of blood in the bathroom and hallway. When the sister-in-law returned to the living room, Garcia was trying to slit his own throat with a butcher knife, which his sister-in-law said she took and threw outside. When the police arrived and began giving medical aid, Garcia repeatedly asked them to kill him before losing consciousness. An autopsy found the cause of death to be laceration from the right earlobe to the left center of the neck, said McLaughlin. Blood in the veins indicate that Cadenas Toreros was alive when she suffered a fatal laceration to her neck. McLaughlin said that Garcia and Cadenas Toreros had been in a relationship. When Cadenas Toreros came to the apartment to collect her clothes, Garcia killed her. Garcia suspected his girlfriend of infidelity and secretly installed cameras inside the apartment to spy on her. Footage from the night of December 13th shows Garcia alternately praying, pacing, and sitting with his head in his hands. At one point, he shuts off the cameras, according to the statement of the case. When they were reactivated, Garcia is seen with blood on his legs. He then makes a movement toward the camera, and the feed ends. Elliot Levine, the defense attorney representing Garcia, noted that Garcia had slit his throat prior to his sister-in-law's arrival, then again after she came into the apartment. There was a lot of suicide ideation at this time and prior to the time. The next court date was set for June 3rd for pretrial conference. Garcia is currently being held at Bridgewater State Hospital. A podcaster takes a fresh look at a 1978 Bellingham slaying. Teresa Corley was just 19 years old when she was murdered on December 6, 1978 in Bellingham. Nearly half a century later, no one has ever been charged. In 2015, Corley's sister, Geraldine Hood, started a Facebook page to drum up public interest in finding the killer. An ongoing Norfolk District Attorney, Michael Morrissey, has said, "The case is one that I would love to solve." Now there's a new podcast that's shining a fresh light on the case, hoping to help Corley's family get some closure. The Forgotten Files of Teresa Corley is a four-part broadcast available on Spotify. Its host, Nicole Ryan, got her start in podcasting during the Karen Reed trial with a podcast called The Reed Report. Ryan, age 28, of East Boston, studied journalism at Emerson College. After the Reed trial, Ryan is originally from Canton, the community where Reed's boyfriend, John O'Keefe, was found dead. She became interested with other Norfolk County cases, which is when she learned about Corley. "I thought there was a story here," she told the Daily News in a recent phone interview. "Sure enough, I started looking into it, and I started researching the case, and I realized there was something there. If you ask most people in Norfolk County if they've heard of Karen Reed, they'll say yes. If you ask them about Teresa Corley, you wouldn't get the same answer." Corley was a student at the now-defunct Holliston Junior College, hoping to become a medical assistant. On December 5, 1978, the Bellingham woman joined friends at a bar called the Train Stop Lounge in Franklin. At the time, the state's drinking age was 18. Corley left the bar at 11:30 p.m., according to reports. She was hitchhiking when she got picked up by four men. They took her to an apartment at the Presidential Arms Apartments in Franklin for several hours, where she was alleged to have been sexually assaulted by them. The men were never charged, and the statute of limitations has expired. After the alleged assaults, she left. She was last seen walking near Bellingham Center early in the morning of December 6th. She never returned home. Her naked body was found on December 8th on the side of the road near the northbound side of Interstate 495. It was determined that she had been strangled. The case has received more attention in recent years, propelled by Corley's family, particularly Hood, who Ryan interviewed for her podcast. Hood has met several times with investigators, pushing to have Corley's body exhumed so that evidence could be collected. Ryan also interviewed other people, including a woman who said she was friends with the man who believed his son killed Corley. Four episodes later, with a range and length of 15 to 18 minutes apiece, discussed the history of the case and the efforts made by Hood and other family members to find the person responsible. This case is about Teresa, but it's also about Hood, too, said Ryan. It's about a sister who wants justice for her sister. This is a tragedy. Teresa was alone, by herself, and she was basically thrown out like trash. You can picture how awful it was if your sister, your mother, any woman close to you, was thrown on the side of the road, naked like this. Hood said she thought the podcast did well and is happy that it may jog more people's memory to get some closure on the case. Former 7 News reporter Lisa Gresci announces a role at another local station. Former WHDH-TV news reporter Lisa Gresci has joined WFXT-TV Boston 25 amid recent staff changes across Boston television news stations. Gresci, who spent 4 years at 7 News, announced a departure from the station in late February. At the time, she hinted at returning to local news and expanding into hosting, event broadcasting, and strategic storytelling. Project she will now pursue alongside her reporting at Boston 25. On March 30th, Gresci confirmed her new role on Facebook, writing, "As promised, I'm back on your local news." She began appearing on air last week, starting with a story about high water bills in Saugus. "I couldn't be more thrilled," she said, "to join the talented team of Boston 25. It was important to me to remain a working journalist, and I'm happy to report this is a station that truly cares about our local communities and wants to hear from viewers about the news they want covered. As an area native, it's been an honor to tell stories here at home for the last decade, and I'm thankful to continue doing so." Boston 25 did not immediately respond to her request for comment. No details were made public about her upcoming work in event broadcasting and strategic storytelling. A North Shore native, Gresci began her television news career at 7 News as a production assistant before heading to South Carolina for her first on-air reporting job, this according to former WHDH staff profile. She then worked at BZTV for 4 years before returning to 7 News as a reporter in January of 2020. At 7 News, she covered countless news stories, including the Brian Walsh murder trial and the relocation of Hasbro from Rhode Island to Boston. Several Boston television news stations have seen personnel changes in recent months as well. Boston 25 reporter Drew Carendis left the station in early March, and chief meteorologist Kevin Lemanowicz departed in late February. Sherry Spear has since taken over as the station's new chief meteorologist. At 7 News, local reporter Eliza Krasinski left in late February, and longtime anchor Kim Kazai departed in December to spend time with family. Jadianne Thompson took over Kazai's slot in January. In WBZ, a former political analyst, John Keller, returned in March after being laid off in October. Lots of changes going on in TV news. Quincy is thinking of banning cell phone use in the schools. The cell phone police could get super strict in Quincy schools this fall. Quincy Public Schools plan to roll out a strict cell phone ban requiring middle and high school students to lock their devices in special pouches for the fall during duration of each school day. Education officials presented the proposal to the Quincy School Board Subcommittee Policy on April 1st. Subcommittee members Paul Brignoli, Tina Cahill, and Catherine Hubley voted unanimously to move the measure out of committee. It comes before the full fall school board will meet on Wednesday, tomorrow, April 8th, for final approval. "We're cutting the cord," said Assistant Superintendent Aaron Perkins, told the Ledger. Perkins said the school policy promises improvements in academic performance, socialization, mental health, and safety. The district would purchase locking pouches manufactured by the company Yoder for every middle school and high school student in the district at a cost of $200,000. Asked by board member Paul Brignoli how the district would cover the expense, Superintendent Kevin Mulvey said, "The district is seeking assistance from the local business community. If that doesn't work, the district would ask to include the purchase in the school's budget." The Yoder pouch uses a magnetic lock on the flap. Typically, students have to turn off or silence their devices, slip them in the pouch in the presence of a staff member, and lock the pouch. They can carry those pouches with them throughout the day or store them in their lockers. They can generally only be unlocked at the end of the day using a special magnet not monitored by staff. The locks are a similar type of magnetized device used by retail security tags on clothes and very difficult to open without obviously damaging the pouch. Currently, the school district has an off-and-away policy where students can use phones at lunch, between classes, and during study halls, but they must have them out. They cannot have them out during class. "It isn't working," Perkins said of the existing policy. "The issue leaves teachers with two equally bad options: disrupt the lesson to confront the offender, or continue instruction and ignore the offense. Any classroom, you're going to see kinds on their cell phones with their earbuds in. It's rampant. We need something consistently and fairly enforced." Quincy Educational Association President Gail Cavello said teachers feel grateful and heard at the prospect of a new policy. "Phones were a major problem when she left the high school classroom in 2021, and the problem has only gotten worse. They're an unnecessary disruption to the delivery of curriculum," she said. "Locking phones and devices away will not only remove a distraction, but will replace it with a healthy interpersonal connection between students and their peers. It will mark a real shift in how kids socialize with each other." Brockton Public Schools implemented a cell phone ban at its high school starting last school year. Brockton High School Principal Kevin McCaskill said the cell phone ban has been tremendous. McCaskill said, "Everyone seems to be pleased with it, including the students. They won't tell you that, but they are refocusing back on education, and it's been tremendous. One of the residuals of it, students are really conversing with each other. They can't look at their phones, so they're actually understanding the art of good conversation." Citing a successful rollout in Taunton and other Massachusetts districts, Perkins said, "Mulvey, they expect the policy will reduce various types of infractions related directly or indirectly to cell phone use. The discipline goes down dramatically. The couple of kids refused to comply with the pouch, but in general, in all other discipline, the heart of it is the cell phone. Quincy's proposal for the two high schools would met out escalating punishments, including hours of detention and ultimately suspension. First violation, phone is confiscated, call home, 2 one-hour official office detentions. Second violation, phone is confiscated, parent or guardian conference, 3 one-hour suspensions and detentions, and 2 hour Saturday detentions, with a 5 hours total. Possible social probation restricting student from extracurricular activities. Third violation, phone confiscation, 1 day in school suspension, and 2 hour Saturday detention. Chronic violations, multi-day suspension, either in or out of school. Social probation if students try to skirt the policy, for instance, by putting a decoy or burner phones in the pouch while hiding their actual phones. They would advance direct to the third violation step on the discipline ladder. This according to their policy. In addition, if students intentionally or irresponsibly lose or damage their pouches, the families will pay $30 to replace them, and the student will have to serve a one-hour detention. This is for students who intentionally try to break open the pouch, Perkins said. It's not for split coffee or normal wear and tear. Perkins said, and Mulvey said also, the administration would work with students whose caregivers may be economically disadvantaged and would have a hard time paying the $30 replacement fee. Middle school discipline does not include detentions and suspensions. Repeated offenses instead result in students losing their right to bring phones to school for the remainder of the year. Middle school students would serve a half-hour detention for intentional or irresponsible damage to the pouch. The policy would not apply to students who require special accommodation due to a health issue or individualized education plans. At the meeting, Perkin gave example of a diabetic student who gave glucose monitors on their phones. Taunton High School rolled out the Yoder pouches at the beginning of the 2025-2026 academic year. 3 months in, high school principal John Harrison reported improvements in academic performance and behavior, as reported by the Taunton Gazette. Taunton's rollout did see a rise in electronic device violation, but the district also listed impressive trends in other areas. For instance, the percentage of students passing all of their classes increased from 67% to 76%. The percentage of students receiving A and B grades increased from 58% to 65%. Physical altercations decreased from 50 to 23%. Harassment, vandalism, and threats decreased by 57%, the Taunton School Committee planned and debated the policy at length before its implementation, holding 5 meetings on the subject in January and February of last year. The district surveyed students, staff, and families and held a parent forum before officially adopting the plan in May of 2025. Taunton's policy, outlined in its handbook, does not include detention for the first offense. The second offense meets with 1 Saturday detention. A third offense could result in long-term suspension. Perkins said Quincy has not yet shared the plans with the parents or teachers. The April 1st subcommittee member was the first time it was discussed in public. The major objection families raised to strict cell phone bans relate to communication in case of emergency, but Perkins and Mulvey said security concerns actually cut the other way. Student caretaker communication can complicate the operations of first responses, placing students at greater risk. The Quincy Police Department agrees. At the April 1st meeting, Lieutenant Matthew Pedzolas, a former school resource officer, outlined a number of safety issues, including emergency response interference. Parents who drive to the schools, for instance, can block routes used by police and other first responders and generally spread confusion. Cell phones have also facilitated and exacerbated dangerous trends in bullying. We deal with it constantly, Mulvey said. Kids take pictures of other kids and post them with negative commentary. It happens on a daily basis. This policy would stop that from happening within the schools anyway. Mulvey said unwanted photos and videos have occurred everywhere in the schools, including bathrooms and locker rooms. In some instances, schools officials have had to refer the incidents to police on grounds that the images constituted child pornography. It's terrible, said Mulvey. On April 18th, there will be a free concert in Quincy with 3 different artists. If you're a fan of the soft rock and storytelling music of the 70s, then there's an upcoming concert in Quincy that you won't want to miss. The concert, entitled Roads and Rivers, an American Songbook, is hosted by the city and will be held at the United First Parish Church, the historic Church of the Presidents, and the adjoining Hancock Adams Common on Saturday, April 18th. The free concert starts at 1 p.m. and will run until 5:45 p.m. It will be split into 3 different performances, and audience members are invited to join, some or all. The first, 1 to 1:30 p.m., will feature the Harvard Crocodiles performing music from the Great American Songbook, as well as the soft rock era. The Crocodiles are Harvard's oldest a cappella group and are affiliated with Harvard's Hasty Pudding Club. The 2:15 to 3:30 p.m., the music of Harry Chapin, Gordon Lightfoot, and Cat Stevens will be performed. Taking the stage to close the concert from 4:15 to 5:45 p.m. will be the Sweet Hitchhiker, a Creedence Clearwater Revival tribute act. The performances will be held inside the church, and speakers will also carry the music in the nearby common. A tent will be set up on the common with tables and chairs for concertgoers to enjoy the food and beverage options from food trucks, as well as to offer shelter in the event of rain. Attendees are invited to bring lawn chairs and blankets to enjoy the music from the common. Food and drinks will not be allowed inside the church. The church will have an open-door policy that afternoon, allowing visitors to come and go during the performances, and seats will not be able to be reserved. Food trucks from Wahlburgers, Georgie's Greek Taverna, and Coffee Break Cafe are scheduled to appear. John Fogerty, a founding member and lead singer of Creedence Clearwater Revival, performed at Quincy's Veterans Stadium last summer with his sons as part of the city's 400th anniversary celebration. The Sunshine brand has returned to its roots. What started by Chris Carbone in 1979 as a produce pushcart in Boston before evolving into a full-blown garden center, Sunshine Gardens in Kingston recently opened Sunshine Marketplace with fresh seasonal produce, a fully stocked floral department, and other local goods. Owned by Jonathan Yacovone and David Connors, the Sunshine Marketplace captures the simplicity and charm of a classic farm stand in a newly renovated space at 191 Summer Street in Kingston. "We wanted to go back to our roots and where this all started," said Yacovone. "There was a huge positive outlook on farm stands and markets versus big box stores. People love the idea of a small market," he said. Carbone started out with a pushcart in Boston's Haymarket Square, selling fresh produce under the name Sunshine Fruit. From 1979 through 1992, he operated outdoor stands in Downtown Crossing and beyond. Carbone opened a permanent Sunshine Fruit location on Water Street in Quincy in 1992 and expanded to selling flowers and other plant material 2 years later. Carbone then partnered with Stephen Willett, known as Willie, in 1994 to open Artery Garden Center on Southern Artery in Quincy. 4 years, Carbone focused on Sunshine Fruit while Willett managed Artery Garden Center. They decided to sell Sunshine Fruit in 1998 so they could focus their energy on building Artery Garden Center into one of the largest garden centers in south of Boston. In 2012, Carbone and Willett opened Sunshine Gardens in Kingston. Willett remained in Quincy operating Artery Garden Center while Carbone operated Sunshine Gardens. They later expanded again with the opening of Sunshine Sundays, a beloved ice cream shop just 14 at the time. Yacovone applied for his first job at Sunshine Gardens in 2013. Carbone took Yacovone under his wing and showed him the ropes. Connors joined Sunshine Gardens in 2019, and in 2024, Carbone and Willett passed the torch and sold Sunshine Gardens to Yacovone and Connors. Located on the same site as Sunshine Gardens and Sunshine Sundays, the marketplace is located in a pre-existing building. Yacovone said they started renovations in January and opened the weekend of March 21st. "It's everything we dreamed of," he said of the storefront. "We tried to mimic as much as we could of the original storefront." He said the market sells its own line of products and things like hippie pilgrim seasoning, local honey, breads baked in Somerville, and pasta sauce from Federal Hill in Providence, Rhode Island. Sunshine Marketplace hired Krista Federico to serve as the produce manager. "We work with local farms for corn, tomato, peppers, and so forth. We bring in local stuff other once the weather shifts, and until then we source from growers so it's not like big box stores. We purchase daily so everything is fresh." A new component of Sunshine is a floral section where people can either purchase pre-made bouquets or create their own using individual stems available for sales. Bridget Wright serves as the floral designer. "We want to keep it at a reasonable price and give the quality you'd get at a florist," Yacovone said. Sunshine Marketplace is located again at 191 Summer Street in Kingston, and the hours are 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. Starbucks teams up with André Grenier ahead of The Devil Wears Prada 2. Starbucks is gearing up for a highly anticipated release of The Devil Wears Prada 2 coming into theaters next month. In a new commercial, André Grenier, known for playing Nate in the 2006 comedy The Devil Wears Prada, tells a barista he isn't upset about not being cast in the upcoming sequel. To calm himself down, he orders one of the coffee chain's new energy refresher, available starting today, Tuesday, April 7th. Starbucks' new energy refreshers are customizable energy drinks based on the coffee chain's popular strawberry acai and mango dragon fruit refreshers. Energy refreshers are made naturally with a blend of vitamin B and caffeine. According to a Starbucks news release, the new energy refreshers include 75 additional milligrams of caffeine per drink size, whereas a grande refresher includes 50 milligrams of caffeine. A new grande energy refresher includes 125 milligrams of caffeine. Devil Wears Prada 2 hits movie theaters on Friday, May 1st, starring the iconic duo Anne Hathaway as Andy Sachs and Meryl Streep as Miranda Priestly. Starbucks can make any of its classic refreshers, including strawberry acai and mango dragon fruit, into an energy refresher. To celebrate the new offering, Starbucks is also debuting a new line of mango strawberry refreshers. The Boston Marathon is around the corner, and the Boston Marathon brings in thousands of runners each year. It makes sense that a few of them happen to be celebrities, and these seven happen to be local. A few big sports names stick out in the records of celebrity marathoners when it comes to Boston's big race. Former Boston Bruins player Zdeno Chara, for example, ran the Boston Marathon with many fans cheering him on. Ex-professional cyclist Lance Armstrong also ran the Boston Marathon. From the world of rock music, Dropkick Murphys member Jeff DeRosa of Watertown is running this year's race, according to Marathon Handbook. The race this year will be on Monday, April 20th. And here are some of the living celebrities and notable athletes from Massachusetts who have also run in Boston's marathon. Most known for her role as Suzanne Crazy Eyes Warren in the hit Netflix women's prison dramedy Orange is the New Black, Uzo Abduba competed the 2015 marathon with a time of 5 hours, 3 minutes, and 24 seconds. She said, whether you're going through hills like Heartbreak Hill, the famous marathon legendary incline, or hills like prison sentences, if you keep going, the other side of the hill is down. You just have to push through because what's on the other side is glorious. The residence actress was born in Boston, raised in Medfield, and graduated from Boston University. Joe DiMassina, country singer, who was born in Framingham and raised in Holliston, ran the 2006 Boston Marathon, fighting through knee injury to complete the race. She's known for her number one hit singles like Bye Bye and Bring on the Rain. Professional golfer Scott Stallings from Worcester completed the 2025 Boston Marathon with a finishing time of 4 hours, 10 minutes, and 19 seconds. Also a proud son of Team Hoyt, Troy Hoyt, who grew up in Billerica, is the grandson of legend Dick Hoyt, who died in 2021, and nephew of marathon icon Rick Hoyt, who died in 2023. Troy Hoyt has finished multiple Boston marathons. He said, when my grandfather could no longer push Rick in races, I had the honor of stepping behind the chair. Rick and I were always as close, but that experience we shared changed my reason for running. I know the answer to every challenge is yes, you can. The website said that Troy Hoyt plans to run the 2026 Boston Marathon as well. Born in Bedford, David McGilvery, the marathon's longtime race director, has also taken part in the race himself many times. He plans to run again this year. He said, I'm no Johnny Kelly. I'm just grateful to still be here, still running, and still part of the greatest race in the world. And that is a wrap for the Patriot Ledger for Tuesday, April 7th. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you have a great day.